since we are small this morning, or thin this morning, I think we'll do this in more discussion format. Usually I'll do that if it's small and if it's just us, but if we have visitors, I usually prefer to just do the sermon because you never know where they're coming from or where they'll lead us if we open it up to a discussion. We had one family here. Originally, when the congregation first started, I did discussions every week instead of a sermon, but we had one family here that no matter what I was talking about, I could have been talking about Samuel, and somehow it was about kosher regulations, and so we wound up having to deal with that every week. So that's why I went away from the discussion format, but it works. It's good. All right, so we are continuing in 1 Samuel. And in the last couple of weeks of our readings, something absolutely revolutionary happened in the life of Israel. Something that had never, ever happened before. And what was that?
King.
They have a king now. An earthly king, a human king. They always had a king, which was God. But now they have an earthly king. And that earthly king's name, we all know, was?
Saul,
so we're all awake. Right. And when he was first called to be king, what was his reaction?
Hidden the baggage.
He didn't want anything. He didn't want to stand up and deal with that. And I was calling it humility, but John corrected me. Timidity would probably be a better term for it, that he was, it was not that. We could see from his later career that it wasn't his problem that he was too humble. The problem was that he was too insecure and scared.
Yeah.
And so that came out and that showed it. All right, so he had one great success so far. And what was that?
He won a battle.
A battle against Nishan of the Ammonites. I saw that lingering conflict that had still been simmering even from Jephthah's time, now finally boiled up into the point where it was a war. And scholars pretty much think that one of the reasons why Israel was crying out for a king was because of Nahash of the Ammonites coming up against them. And they were scared, and they had seen mixed results with the judges, and so they said, oh, they didn't identify it with their own sin, but instead they identified it with their leadership and said, oh, we need a king to lead us through this. Everybody around us has a king. Let's get ourselves a king. Then we never have to worry about this following God stuff again. Right? And Samuel, in the second ordination of Saul, he had something to say about that. And what was that about? What happens if they fell away from God? What would happen?
To learn that they had an earthly king, the king was going to use them for his own convenience.
Right. And that if they had fallen away, that they went into battle, both they and their king would perish, that the king was not going to save them. Yeah. In other words, God was saying, good try, but it's not going to work. You're still not going to get out of following me. So that takes us to the further career of Saul, in chapter 13 of 1 Samuel. And the first verse is something that the Hebrew is, should I say it, the JPS likes to mark it as Hebrew uncertain, and that is certainly true of this first verse. Nobody's quite sure what they're trying to say. If you got the New American Standard, they pencil in two words in italics. Those are two important words. Okay, and the verse reads in the New American Standard, which we read from. Saul was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 42 years over Israel. Problem is that those words 30 and 40 are not in the verse. And so the Hebrew cries out for a number there. As a matter of fact, it actually says Saul was 1 year old when he began to reign, which certainly isn't true because he immediately was hiding in the baggage and leading people into battle, and a 1 year old certainly wouldn't do those sorts of things. He also had we'll find out in a little bit, a son, Jonathan. He was probably even older than 30. Some people think that's even a bad approximation, because Jonathan was leading men into battle, his son,
yeah,
when he became king, and so his son certainly was older than 10 years old, 10 or 15 years old. So chances are Saul was actually even older than this.
When he had been 20 in order to go into battle?
That's true, because, that was, and certainly in Moses' time, when he numbered the people, was 20 years old and upward. So it was most likely the same kind of deal, although we're not sure how old David was when he went up against Goliath. He may have been younger than that. But, yeah. And the 40 years, people put that in because it makes it a nice symmetry. You know, David, Solomon, both reigned for 40 years, and so they put in the 40 years to make it symmetrical, but some people think it could have been as short as 20 or even shorter than that. So.
Yeah, because if you look at Saul's activities,
mm-hmm,
it didn't appear as though he was a good leader for a long time.
No, it didn't seem like it was strung out for 40 years. No, it seemed like it was shorter than that. All right, so in verse 2, that is the traditional way in which Scripture or the book of Samuel, Judges, or Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles introduce the reign of a new king. They identify how old they were when they began to reign and how long they reigned. Verse 2, now Saul chose for himself 3,000 men of Israel, of which 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash and in the hill country of Bethel, while 1,000 were with Jonathan at Gibeah of Benjamin, but he sent away the rest of the people, each to his tent. That was this big army that he started with when he went up against the Ammonites. He had a very big army, so he sent most of them away. Not sure why. Maybe he didn't think he needed them. Verse 3, Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba, and the Philistines heard of it. Then Saul blew the trumpet throughout the land, saying, "Let the Hebrews hear." All Israel heard the news that Saul had smitten the garrison of the Philistines, and also that Israel had become odious to the Philistines. The people were then summoned to Saul at Gilgal. Okay, so one thing here that was a little bit of a wrinkle in verse 4, there's something there that's not quite the truth, although it might have been understandable. What's the little fib there?
Well, so the Saul had this victory, and it was really
Saint Jonathan. Yep. Now, in some sense, you could kind of say that Saul as the ultimate leader would have the ultimate victory, but it considering other things that went on after this with Saul, you could kind of see the beginning of the cracks forming in his character, that this would go on. Verse 5, now the Philistines assembled to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen, and people like the sand which is on the seashore in abundance, and they came up and camped in Michmash, east of Beth Avon. So it was an army. So they looked down from Gilgal, and they saw spread out in the plain below an army, a humongous army. Verse 6, when the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, for the people were hard pressed, and the people hid themselves in caves and thickets and cliffs and cellars and in pits. Also some of the Hebrews crossed the Jordan into the land of Gad and Gilead. And as for Saul, he was still in Gilgal, and all the people followed him, trembling. So, how's it looking here? It's not looking good.
Because of the number of people that Israel came across,
mm-hmm,
really made them a threat.
Mm-hmm.
So they started hiding from the people.
They started hiding in all kinds of things. All kinds of things.
But
see, Saul had a problem here. He did. He started out with an army, and now we're not sure what he's got. People are panicking all around. They're digging themselves pits and hiding themselves in caves and in thickets, you know, in the brambles, in the bushes. People are literally hiding in the bushes. So, what should Saul and the people have been doing at this point?
Should
have been praying. Yeah, should have been praying, calling out to God. They should be calling out to God with this. But, you know, get the feeling that that's what they were doing. Verse 8. Now he waited 7 days, according to the appointed time set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattering from him. So Saul had a problem. He had a problem. He started out with this army of 3,000 people, and it was disintegrating. People in terror were fleeing. They were dropping away. Verse 9, so Saul said, bring to me the burnt offering, the peace offerings. And he offered the burnt offering. Now, scholars debate on as to what exactly was going on here. But I think, because in some sense, just like you could say that Saul won the battle even though Jonathan fought it, you could say that Saul offered the burnt offerings even though a priest at his command offered it. But I don't think that's true. I think that he himself offered it just by the way that this is phrased. He said, bring to me the burnt offering, which seems to be rather specific that he himself was going to take it upon himself to offer it.
Even at that time,
mm-hmm.
Samuel refused to go to Gilgal.
No, he didn't. Samuel was just late. Samuel was late. So, what do you think about this, about Saul offering the sacrifice by himself?
He was not the right person to do it. He was not ordained to do that.
Who was ordained to do it?
The priest.
So, how about Samuel?
Samuel could do it.
Why?
Because God gave him that exception. Mm-hmm. Even though he was a judge, he could act as priest.
He could act as priest. And, in fact, he was probably of what tribe?
Levi.
He was probably Levite.
Levi.
So it was not as big a stretch for God to allow a Levite who had charge of the vessels of the sanctuary to grant him the grace or the permission to offer sacrifices. But Saul
came from the tribe of Benjamin.
Yes. what was dangerous about this fact that Saul was going to, that the king was going to be also offering sacrifices? What do you think?
He thought too high of himself.
Yeah, he was appropriating to himself all the authority of the land. God had designed the kingship to be limited by the priests and prophets, but for the king to say, I'm going to do everything, then he really was an absolute monarch, and there was no check on his authority whatsoever, so it was a really bad thing. Really bad thing.
Only absolute one that we have is Jesus Christ.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. No, nobody else. And certainly, in Israel should have understood that, even though Saul seems to be taking on a pagan model that the kings of the surrounding nations did everything. They officiated in the temples. They were the rulers of the land, and Saul seemed to have been building his kingdom on a pagan model. All right, so verse 10. As soon as he finished offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came, and Saul went out to meet him and to greet him. And actually, that's kind of a stretch on the translation. It could have been salute, and some places say salute, but other places translate that word to bless him, that Saul went out to bless Samuel, because it's the same word when you say the blessings, the berukah. Or when we say Baruch Atah Adonai, blessed are you. It's Baruch. So Saul went out to bless Samuel, and there was an attitude there, or there was kind of an undertone there of greeting an equal, or even of blessing someone who was subordinate.
Yeah.
So, verse 11, but Samuel said, "What have you done?" Ooh, daddy's home. You know, it's like a child is doing something, thinks he's getting away with it. What's the first word that comes out of your mouth when you come home and you see that, you know, the pillow cushion's all shredded and there's insulation everywhere, and the child comes out of you with a smile. "What have you done?" And Saul said, "Because I saw that the people were scattering from me, and that you did not come within the appointed days, and that the Philistines were assembled at Michmash." All of that was true. However, the therefore really doesn't follow. "Therefore I said, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not asked the favor of the Lord. So I forced myself and offered the burnt offering." And I don't think that was true, that he forced himself, but it was true that his army was frittering away. And we'll see how much is left. Verse 13, Samuel said to Saul, "You have acted foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him as ruler over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you." And Samuel rose and went up from Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin, and Saul numbered the people who were present with him, about 600 men. So he did lose a lot. He went from 3,000 down to 600. So he lost something like 80% of the people who were there. Now Saul and his son Jonathan and the people who were present with them were staying in Geba of Benjamin while the Philistines camped at Michmash. And the raiders came from the camp of the Philistines in three companies. One company turned toward Ophrah, the land of Shual. Another company turned toward Beth Horon. Another company turned toward the border which overlooks the valley of Zeboim, toward the wilderness. Now no blacksmith could be found in all the land of Israel. But the Philistines said, "Otherwise the Hebrews will make swords or spears." So all Israel went down to the Philistines east to sharpen his plowshares, his mattock, his axe, and his hoe. The charge was 2/3 of a shekel for the plowshares, the mattocks, the forks, and the axes, and to fix the hoes. So it came about on the day of battle that neither sword nor spear was found in the hands of any of the people who were with Saul and Jonathan, but they were found with Saul and his son Jonathan. The garrison of the Philistines went out to the pass of Michmash. So we see here that the Philistines kind of had Israel by the throat. We think about blacksmithing, it's so easy. You know, you can do not so much in this area, but in other places, blacksmiths are easy to find. My boss does blacksmithing as a hobby. He has a forge somewhere in his property, and he goes out and does things. And, you know, we all see shows and movies about the Old West when there was pretty much a blacksmith in every town, or maybe even a couple of blacksmiths in the town kept busy. But in those days, blacksmithing was quite an art. And the Philistines said, "No forge will be found anywhere, all land of Israel, except here." And had to go to the Philistines and deal with them for forging. So weapons were at a premium, because certainly the Philistine blacksmiths were not going to sharpen anybody's swords. They weren't going to make swords for people. So all you had were farm implements, really. All right, into chapter 14. Now the day came that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who was carrying his armor, "Come and let us cross over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side." But he did not tell his father. All right, so here's two guys going to cause some trouble. Saul was staying in the outskirts of Gibeah under the pomegranate tree, which is in Migron, and the people who were with him were about 600 men. And Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the priest of the Lord at Shiloh, was wearing an ephod. the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. Right, so this is a descendant of Eli. We were looking at this before trying to figure out what relation it was. So here we go. We got Eli's son was Phinehas. His grandson was Ahitub. His great grandson was Ahijah. So was the generation. So if you think about it, some time had passed for Samuel. Verse 4, between the passes by which Jonathan sought to cross over to the Philistines' garrison, there was a sharp crag on the one side and a sharp crag on the other side. The name of the one was Bozez and the name of the other Senah. The one crag rose on the north opposite Michmash, and the other on the south opposite Geba. Then Jonathan said to the young man who was carrying his armor, "Come and let us cross over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. Perhaps the Lord will work for us, for the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few." His armor bearer said to him, "Do all that is in your heart, turn yourself, and here I am with you according to your desire." And then Jonathan said, "Behold, we will cross over to the men and reveal ourselves to them. They say to us, 'Wait until we come to you,' then we will stand in our place and not go up to them. If they say, 'Come up to us,' then we will go up, for the Lord has given them into our hands, and this shall be the sign to us." So I set forth a sign, saying whether they were going to go up and press the battle or not. And in a sense, it was a logical sign. Because if the Philistines were lazy and kind of almost asleep at their duty and not want to go down and check them out, then they would probably be easy pickings. Verse 11. And both of them revealed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines. The Philistines said, "Behold, Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden themselves." Which, in a sense, is true, right? We read about that. They were digging holes for themselves. They were hiding themselves in pits and bushes and everywhere. So the men of the garrison hailed Jonathan, his armor-bearer, and said, "Come up to us, and we will tell you something." Jonathan said to his armor-bearer, "Come up after me, for the Lord has given them into the hands of Israel." I think on the sense of the Philistines, that was more or less, "Come here and I'll show you something. Come here. Let me show you something. Something you're not going to like." So that was their equivalent of it. But the Philistines weren't going to actually tell them something, but rather they were going to come up there and they were going to deal with them. Verse 13, then Jonathan climbed up on his hands and feet with his armor-bearer behind him, and they fell before Jonathan, and his armor-bearer put some to death after him. And so even his armor-bearer got in the act. And he knows what his training was. That first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor-bearer made was about 20 men with about half a furrow and an acre of land. So it was a small battle. There was a trembling in the camp and the field among all the people. Even the garrison and the raiders trembled. The earth quaked so that it became a great trembling. And so Jonathan started this off. And then what happened after that? He took it further.
God,
what did God do?
Yeah.
He brought an earthquake. So here, Jonathan wins this little battle, 20 people, and a little bit of land, and that kind of breaks the ice in the sense that God now takes the action. Sometimes all it takes is one act of faith by one person, no matter how small, and then God acts and takes it from there. So here he had Saul back in Gibeah, verse 16. Now Saul's watchmen in Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude melted away, and they went here and there. Saul said to the people who were with him, "Number now and see who has gone from us." And when they had numbered, behold, Jonathan and his armor-bearer were not there. And Saul said to Ahijah, "Bring the ark of God here," for the ark of God was at that time with the sons of Israel. While Saul talked to the priest, the commotion in the camp of the Philistines continued to increase. So Saul said to the priest, withdraw your hand, in other words, never mind. I got the answer. Then Saul and all the people who were with him rallied and came to the battle. Behold, every man's sword was against his fellow, and there was very great confusion. That was among the Philistines. Now the Hebrews who were with the Philistines previously, who went up with them all around in the camp, even they also turned to be with the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. And all the men of Israel who had hidden themselves in the hill country of Ephraim heard the Philistines had fled, even they also pursued them closely in the battle. So the Lord delivered Israel that day, and the battle spread beyond Beth Aven. The men of Israel were hard pressed on that day, for Saul had put the people under oath, saying, cursed be the man who eats food before evening, and until I have avenged myself on my enemies. So none of the people tasted food. What do you think about that? What do you think?
I don't think it was
why. Why do you think, what else do you see in there that raises concern? Decided not being wise.
It was not what he did. I don't think it came from God. Mm-hmm. It came from Saul himself.
Mm-hmm.
When the people are fighting, they need food to stay strong.
Right. Because it was this whole that whole phrase, until I have avenged myself on my enemies, not until I have brought victory to the enemies of Israel by the hands of God. It showed really a self-centeredness and a lack of concern for the people whom he was leading.
And mind you, he was not the one who even started the battle.
Right.
It was
yes.
His son
did it. His son was the brave.
His son was very close to God.
Right.
And him.
Yeah.
And now, after things appear successful, mm-hmm. and he came from out of the woodworks to pronounce such a thing on them.
Yeah.
And it was not altogether from, it was not anything that came from God.
Yeah.
It came from him.
Yeah. It came from him. Verse 25, all the people of the land entered the forest, and there was honey on the ground. When the people entered the forest, behold, there was a flow of honey, but no man put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath. But Jonathan had not heard when his father put the people under the oath. Therefore he put out the end of his staff that was in his hand and dipped it in the honeycomb, put his hand to his mouth, and his eyes brightened. And one of the people said, your father strictly put the people under oath, saying, cursed be the man who eats food today. The people were weary. And Jonathan said, my father has troubled the land. See now how my eyes have brightened because I tasted a little of this honey. How much more if only the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies which they found. For now the slaughter among the Philistines has not been great. In fact, that sowed the seed later on for Goliath and David and all the rest. Because, you know, had Saul perhaps been more devoted to the Lord, had he waited for Samuel, had Samuel told him what he was supposed to do, had he allowed the people to eat, and he fulfilled all that, the Philistines might have been dealt with there, then and there,
mm-hmm.
and his kingdom would have been established because there would have been no David needful to confront Goliath because there would have been no Goliath challenging the army of Israel.
See, that when you put yourself twice instead of God, mm-hmm. the problem that you will come across down the road, mm-hmm. God would deal with it before him,
mm-hmm.
and further down the road, we'll not have problems.
Yeah, little problems tend to become big problems when you do it. Try to solve them yourselves.
Yeah.
And it gets worse. Verse 31. They struck among the Philistines that day from Michmash to Ajalon, and the people were very weary. People rushed greedily upon the spoil, and took sheep and oxen and calves and slew them on the ground. The people ate them with the blood, which they were not supposed to do. That was forbidden. You don't eat the meat with the blood. And they told Saul, saying, behold, people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood. And he said, you have acted treacherously. Roll a great stone up to me today. Saul said, disperse yourselves among the people and say to them, each one of you bring me his ox or his sheep and slaughter it here and eat. And do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood. So all the people that night brought each one his ox with him and slaughtered it there. And Saul built an altar to the Lord. It was the first altar that he built to the Lord. So once again, it seems like Saul is acting as priest here. Yes, the people shouldn't be eating blood, but he's building an altar there. He's telling the people to bring the livestock here to slaughter. It sounds a lot like he's acting as a priest and sacrificing these things on the altar of God and giving them back to the people.
Never consulted God in anything.
No, he didn't. Yeah,
everything he would take upon himself.
Yep. Now he's on his own. He's solidly he's driving the bus now. He's pushed God out of the driver's seat and now he's driving the bus, and that's not going to work out well. Verse 36, and Saul said, "Let us go down after the Philistines by night and take spoil among them until the morning light, and let's not leave a man of them." They said, "Do whatever seems good to you." So the priest said, "Let us draw near to God here." Saul inquired of God, "So I go down after the Philistines, will you give them into the hand of Israel?" But he did not answer him on that day. Well, I can conjecture why not. I mean, at this point, Saul was so far from God that how could God answer?
He had become upon himself.
Yeah.
Previously.
Yeah.
When he was supposed to consult God before.
The only thing that he apparently couldn't do when he said, "Let's draw near to God here and consult," it was the Urim and the Thummim, which was apparently what the priest had that Saul couldn't operate. And he at least didn't draw that upon himself. Verse 38, Saul said, "Draw near here, all you chiefs of the people, and investigate and see how this sin has happened today. For as the Lord lives, who delivers Israel, though it is in Jonathan, my son, he shall surely die." And not one of all the people answered him. They said to Israel, "All Israel, you shall be on one side, and I and Jonathan, my son, will be on the other side." And the people said to Saul, "Do what seems good to you." Therefore Saul said to the Lord God of Israel, "Give a perfect lot." Jonathan and Saul were taken, but the people escaped. Saul said, "Cast lots between me and Jonathan, my son," and Jonathan was taken. Then Saul said to Jonathan, "Tell me what you have done." So Jonathan told him and said, "I indeed tasted a little honey with the end of the staff that was in my hand. Here I am, I must die." Saul said, "May God do this to me and more also, for you should surely die, Jonathan." The people said to Saul, "Must Jonathan die, who has brought about this great deliverance in Israel? Far from it. As the Lord lives, not one hair of his head shall fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day." So people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die. And Saul went up from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place. Why do you think that God allowed the lot to show Jonathan here?
God, between Jonathan and Saul,
yeah.
Jonathan was closer to God.
But this was showing, I mean, Saul had just promised that whoever had violated, but whoever had sinned today should die. And the lot chose Jonathan. It seems to me that... What's that?
I think God is paving the way for David.
In some sense, he was paving the way for David, but in another sense, it was showing something to Jonathan, and it was showing something to Saul, and it was showing something to the people.
Oh, okay.
It was demonstrating Saul's heart that he was willing to kill his own son because his son had violated the oath that Saul himself had put. Here he had all these people that had eaten meat with the blood, and the lot was not taken from any of them, because had the lot been pointed to any of those people, Saul would have put them to death. So in some sense, God having the lot fall to Jonathan saved everybody's life, because at this point they were not going to let Jonathan be put to death, and so nobody got put to death that day. Had anybody else been chosen by lot, then Saul would have put them to death. That's just my conjecture. They don't write that in the margin of your Bible, but it seems to me that God works in mysterious ways. That day,
Rabbi, you're right.
Yeah. So, okay, verse 47. Now, when Saul had taken the kingdom over Israel, he fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, sons of Ammon, Edom, the king of Zobah, the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he inflicted punishment. He acted valiantly and defeated the Amalekites and delivered Israel from the hands of those who plundered them. Now the sons of Saul were Jonathan and Ishvi and Malchishua, and the names of his two daughters were these: the name of the firstborn Merab, and the name of the younger Michal. The name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam, the daughter of Ahimaaz. The name of the captain of his army was Abner, the son of Ner, Saul's uncle. Kish was the father of Saul, and Ner the father of Abner was the son of Abiel. Now the war against Philistines was severe all the days of Saul, and Saul saw any mighty man or any valiant man, he attached him to his staff. Right, so here we have really Saul starting his accelerating downward spiral. Right, we saw Saul kind of wobbling a little bit, and what we have now is not a wobble, we have a full-blown downward spiral out of him, because he is now charging off, doing things on his own, and making these rash oaths over the people. And so there is a bad moon rising at this point. Any other thoughts about this passage? Or any other questions that have come up?
It really appears that what happened between Saul and Jonathan,
mm-hmm.
Jonathan clearly got to understand that
mm-hmm.
his father was not a king that God chose anymore.
Mm-hmm.
This is where it fell out.
Mm-hmm.
This is where it appears to be that Jonathan got to know where he should stand.
Jonathan got this picture here of his father.
Yeah.
That's going to be deepened in the following chapters. Stan?
Just seems strange to me that since Jonathan did not hear Saul's vow,
yep.
he was found guilty.
Right. Yeah, that is the strange part. That's why the only thing I could think of is this was God's plan, that nobody would die that day. It wasn't God pointing out that Jonathan needed to die because he violated the oath. Because Jonathan had acted innocently. He had not heard the vow. And the vow itself was not a vow made by God or to Jonathan. It was just something that Saul came up with.
That kind of also showed injustice on Saul's part,
mm-hmm.
that somebody would be guilty who had not
right.
heard the decree.
That's right. Yeah, I think the reason that God no longer answered Saul was because Saul at this point was turning into a sociopathic murderer, and God didn't honor that. But
lots of concern. It seems to me the Lord just showed him what he asked.
Right.
He said, "Give a perfect lot, and Jonathan and Saul were taken, but the people escaped."
Yeah.
So forth, and then cast it between Jonathan and his father. And so he just showed him, well, he's the one that broke the vow.
Yep.
But now, as far as where that goes and why the vow should have been taken and all that, that's what's being dealt with after that.
That is true. And God did not dictate any kind of penalty for this. Saul was the one who said that he violated the vow shall die. It was certainly not anything that that God had commanded. It was not part of God's prescription for a penalty for something like that. That was something that Saul took upon himself.
Yeah.
So he was all.
That's why the people went against him.
That's right. People said, "No, no, no! You can't do that."
Yeah.
He's the guy who started all this.
Yeah.
He's the great. He's the hero of the battle.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we killing the hero of the battle today? It doesn't make any sense. It didn't. It didn't.
But then he goes on to say right after that that he says he went up and pursued the Philistines. The Philistines went there in place. But then he goes on to say how he fought against all the enemies there and was victorious.
Right. In a sense, it's almost like this ended the reign of Saul as far as God was concerned.
Right.
So this chapter fits the pattern of the rest of Scripture, that it begins with this king became king at some such an age and reigned for so many years, and it usually ends with recounting his deeds. And it's almost like this chapter ends with recounting the deeds of Saul, that as far as God was concerned, there isn't much more to be said about his reign, because after this it's going to be worse news for Saul, but at this point, it's going to be shifting from Saul to David. So it's almost like this is a transition at the end of that chapter, saying as far as God was concerned, the jig was up, it was over.
Yeah.
Saul's reign was over.
This is just a recount of what he did up to this point?
What he would do for the rest of his reign. That was recapping the whole of his history as king of Israel.
Okay.
So it begins with when he started, how long he reigned, and this little section ends with a summary of all of his accomplishments. And so now the focus is going to turn from Saul. There's a little bit in the next chapter with Samuel dealing with the Amalekites, but pretty much after this, the focus is going to be from David's point of view. So, in a sense, God's said everything about Saul that he needs to say about his reign, other than how it impacts David.
He had proven himself.
Yeah.
Who he is.
Yeah.
But everything was about him.
Yes.
And not God.
Right.
He took God out of the picture.
Yep. So, in the next sections, we're going to see Saul from Saul's point of view, but we're going to see Saul from Samuel's point of view, and then we're going to see Samuel or Saul from David's point of view. So in writing, you talk about point of view and whose point of view, and it went from Saul's point of view now to Samuel's point of view and then to David's point of view, but you're not going to see Saul's point of view anymore. He, as far as God's concerned, he's done. Let's close in prayer. Dearest God and Father, I thank you for your word and the fact that you have recorded not just the pleasant sunshine topics, but also the topics that people show themselves to be less than perfect. Teach us to have a heart like Jonathan's, that we might rely upon you, and that we might do nothing for our own glory, or for our own sakes, or by our own plan, but that we would seek you out and your guidance in everything, and that in everything that happens, that we would glorify you and our Messiah, Yeshua. Amen.